A new plan for protecting the U.S. from global cyber threats. Maine Senator Angus King and his colleagues on the Cyberspace Solarium Commission today released their proposed strategy for the nation to defend itself from cyber attacks and deter future aggression. The report concludes a year of work for the bipartisan commission and contains more than 75 recommendations, including the creation of a new bureau within the State Department that's dedicated to cyberspace security. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we'll talk with Senator King and fellow commission co-chair, Republican Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, about the findings released today. We'll also talk with Peter Warren Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at the nonpartisan think tank New America. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Burn In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. Setting a new course for cyberspace security, today on Maine Calling. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. In today's interconnected world, it's a reality that all of our personal data, our energy, telecommunication infrastructure, even our electoral system is at risk from cyber attack. Today, the Cyberspace Solarium Commission is issuing its guidelines for how to prevent a catastrophic cyber attack on our country. Independent Senator Angus King of Maine and Republican Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin are the co-chairs of the commission, and they join us from the Senate studios in Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Peter Warren Singer. He's a strategist and senior fellow at New America, a nonpartisan think tank, and he's the author of the upcoming book, Burn In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. He joins us from his office in Washington. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned about particular aspects of U.S. cybersecurity? Do you have questions about what individuals can do to decrease risks online? Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Thanks to you for joining us on what I assume is a pretty busy day. And Representative Gallagher, I know you're kind of in a time crunch, so I'll let you go first here. You're delivering here the findings of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, a year in the making. There are 75-plus recommendations. We won't be able to get to all of those here in an hour, but what would you just say are the big ideas coming from this year's worth of work?
Well, first of all, let me just say what a pleasure it was to work with Senator King. And though I'm a Wisconsinite, I've really grown to love Maine in this process. And I've never seen him not wearing a lobster tie in over a year of working with him closely.
I'll get you one.
I will proudly wear it. I would say there are a few things. One, the overall strategy we are laying out of layered cyber deterrence is really the most comprehensive approach, or at least we hope we can convince those in the executive branch in Congress of the need to combine a more robust mechanism for imposing costs against those adversaries who test us in cyber and reducing our attack surface, denying our adversaries the ability to take down our grid, for example. And then the third layer of that is how do we shape behavior by working more closely with our allies? And so we believe deterrence is possible in cyberspace, and we lay out the roadmap to getting there. But I think what makes this report unique is that we are recognizing just how important it is in cyber, where something like 85% of the critical infrastructure is controlled by the private sector, to convince the private sector to step up, and also for the federal government to be a more agile and productive partner with the private sector. And we have a variety of recommendations that are geared towards enhancing that public-private collaboration that we believe is critical to securing the homeland and really securing the free world in cyberspace going forward.
So is this also to get this on the minds of sort of more in the forefront of the minds of the White House, of the Congress, of everybody? What sort of job one?
Yes, and I will defer to Senator King. We really feel like if nothing else, we hope this report will convince not only those who work in the executive branch or the legislative branch that we have a serious problem on our hands and the status quo is insufficient in cyber, but will inform the average American citizen that they need to care about what is happening in cyber and they need to demand comprehensive reform from the federal government.
Yeah. Senator King, what's your take after this year's worth of work?
Well, I think the first thing I want to say about the commission is that it was entirely nonpartisan. We had 14 members, four members of Congress, four members from the executive branch, and six members from the private sector, plus hundreds of people that we interviewed, talked to, read during this process. I think we had 29 or 30 meetings. We met essentially every Monday for a year. One of the biggest things, and Mike touched on this, is that we're under attack. We're under attack right now. Talking to a utility executive recently, his grid system is attacked 3 million times a day. And I was talking to a small bank in Maine 100,000 times a day or in a few days. So this is and it's, you know, our bank accounts, our healthcare records, our the airline industry, I mean, you name it, there's a threat, and there's someone. It's either a state actor like Russia or China or Iran or North Korea, or outright criminals, and everybody gets these emails, send money and we'll take care of everything for you. But this is a really serious problem. Billions of dollars have been stolen from the United States, particularly in intellectual property. So I think the first job is to understand and realize that this is a really serious problem. My fear, Keith, is that the next Pearl Harbor will be cyber.
And so, as you're mentioning, the front lines of this really are at the very local level. It's it's a bank, it's some institution that has its own IT.
The town of Augusta had a ransomware attack.
Yeah, so this is where it's being fought. How then does a bureau at the Department of State or the naming of sort of federal agents, how does that add, I guess, or assist those people on those small fronts?
Well, that's a really good question, and there's no single solution. My friend Laurie LaChance up at Thomas College often says there's no silver bullet. There's often silver buckshot. Lots of small solutions which add up to it. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of the most important things is individual decisions about opening an email that you don't know what's in it, hitting on an attachment, having what's called two-factor authentication to get into your accounts. Sometimes we find those things annoying, takes a little more time, but something like 90% of the personal hacking that goes on could be eliminated by the cyber equivalent of washing your hands, being more careful. On the government side, one of the main things we want to do is impose costs on our adversaries. In other words, they shouldn't feel that we're a cheap date, that they can attack our elections and not pay any price. Because if we don't impose a deterrent, if we don't impose some costs, they're going to keep doing it. Why not? Why wouldn't they? It's cheap. So I think, again, it's hard to measure prevention. It's hard to measure something that doesn't happen. But that's really a very big part of what we're proposing is preventive measures to keep these attacks, to slow them down and keep them to a minimum, and also be ready to respond, to help companies and the private sector with resilience so we can defend ourselves. It's called denial of these attacks. So it's a big tapestry that involves everything from how individuals handle their email up to how the federal government responds to a serious attack.
Yeah. Representative Gallagher, how far behind are we here in the United States in being able to defend ourselves, to deter future attacks, to be in a good position, a position of strength going forward? How far behind are we?
Well, I believe in engaging with the head of the NSA and Cyber Command, General Nakasone, some of the leaders in DOD that work on this issue every day, we have made important progress in the last few years. For example, in partnership with some of the authorities that we've loosened up in Congress, we've allowed our cyber warriors to really pursue a doctrine of what's called defend forward and persistent engagement, effectively responding to and containing malicious cyber activity before it devolves into a major crisis. So that's been an important shift over the last 3 years. Part of what we're recommending is how do we elevate that into a comprehensive strategy, and all how do we extend it beyond the military to include the other instruments of national power and to include the private sector. So I guess I would say we've made important progress, but we are not moving as fast as we need to move, particularly as it pertains to public-private cooperation. But I will say, the dilemma you face when you're analyzing this from an American perspective is that while we have some of the most powerful cyber weapons in our arsenal, because our society is so open and so free, we also have enormous vulnerabilities. And so we really tried to strike the right balance in all of our recommendations that pertain to the private sector between how do we incentivize them to work with the government without saddling them with duplicative or onerous regulations. In other words, we don't want to be more like the Chinese Communist Party. We want to preserve the unique freedom and innovative environment that will be our long-term path to success against our strategic competitors like the Chinese Communist Party. But we are going to need everyone to step up and recognize they have a role to play in this cyber fight.
So how would you get at that, trying to balance that, rather than make threats or place rules and restrictions? You're proposing things like insurance incentives or, you know, sort of economic incentives to get the private sector to adhere to, you know, stricter or more rigorous practices.
So one thing we recommend that I think will get at this and prove important over time is for publicly traded companies and critical infrastructure companies, having them undergo mandatory penetration testing to see on a routine basis how secure they are. And while they wouldn't be forced to immediately disclose the results of those tests in a way that could tank their stock price, for example, or hurt future investments, we would want that information on hand. And in the event of a major cyber attack, we would be able to interrogate that data to determine if someone was negligent and figure out how we can fix the system going forward. So that is the balance we've tried to strike. The other thing I would highlight is that we want to start the process of planning for a major cyber attack right now, something called continuity of the economy. In the way that in the mid-50s, the nuclear threat from the Soviet Union inspired us to start planning for continuity of government and continuity of operations, we are recommending now, in the digital era where our economy is entirely dependent on digital networks, we should have a robust plan for continuity of the economy that the government will lead but will include buy-in from the private sector so we are not caught unaware in the event of the worst-case scenario.
You mentioned the Cold War era. In fact, the name of the commission, the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, is borrowed or inspired from Project Solarium, which was put forth by President Eisenhower to kind of shape Cold War strategy. Can you give us a little history of that and the link between that effort and this one?
I worry that Senator King's going to roll his eyes. I've talked too much about the history of Solarium. I'll try and
be brief. He wrote his PhD thesis on this. You're going to regret having asked that question.
He has to
go. Never get invited to Maine. So basically, May 8th, 1953, Stalin had died a few months before. The Soviets had obviously detonated a nuclear weapon in 49. Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles are in the White House Solarium, and they start to have this conversation in which they say the course we're on, the course that the Truman administration had laid out in sort of the second version of its foreign policy with NSC 68, was not sustainable. We're headed towards disaster. And so they proposed a competitive exercise among three teams of the brightest experts, both in government and outside experts. And over the course of 6 weeks at the National War College, they developed three distinct strategies for approaching the Soviet Union. And then they competed in a day-long meeting of the National Security Council on July 16th, 1953. And from that, after subsequent months of working to cobble together certain parts of the three different teams, emerged Eisenhower's new look grand strategy, NSC 162-2. And there are a lot of scholars, myself included, who believe that that strategy, while it underwent significant changes both within the Eisenhower administration and obviously in the subsequent decades of the Cold War, really laid the foundation for what a sustainable variant of containment would be. And so we took inspiration from that in having a competitive approach, evaluating three different paths in cyber. But we should admit, though Angus King is perhaps the wisest legislator I know, neither of us are Eisenhower, and this was not a top secret presidentially driven process. This was a open, congressionally driven process.
Keith, let me jump in. A couple of things. Number one, Augusta is a city. I said a town. I don't want your switchboard to light up with people from Augusta. I got to get that straightened out.
I thought we were talking about the Masters there first.
Yeah, right. Secondly, we got a lot of Masters in Augusta, Maine. But secondly, on the question of the threat, it's about to increase dramatically with 5G. Because we're moving into a world where if we think we're connected now, everything is going to be connected. Cars, televisions, computers, laptops, cellular phones, your microwave, everything is going to be connected to the web and to the internet and therefore subject to attack. And this is just going to multiply the risk to all of our daily lives. And that's one of the reasons we feel such a sense of urgency about this.
There's lots more to this report, obviously, but as we head into our the first break here, I do want to ask just a political question here. It's a bipartisan commission. You seem to have worked together well on this, but you have to get this by your colleagues. This has to be approved by Congress. The funding has to be approved. And it has to happen in a highly polarized election year that's with distractions, a lot of distractions, including what's happening with coronavirus, which I hope to talk about a little later. So the prospects then of getting all of this work turned into legislation that can become a reality, what are the prospects for that?
You know, I think owing to the unique makeup of the commission with four sitting legislators, two members of the House and two senators, we really feel like we have a unique opportunity to immediately inject our proposals into the legislative bloodstream. And indeed, in most of the cases where we're recommending Congress should do this or Congress must do that, we've actually gone through the work of writing draft legislation in an appendix that people can access to make it easy for our colleagues to, you know, for lack of a better term, copy and paste some of the work that we've already done. And so we think we have an opportunity to get some of this passed on the National Defense Authorization Act this year. We've already started to have conversations with the relevant committee chairs, and we hope that that will, you know, really distinguish the work of this commission, is that it's not just a report that's going to collect dust on a shelf. It was a blueprint for action.
But Keith, we shouldn't underestimate the difficulty. I mean, it's hard to move things in this town. One of our recommendations, for example, is that Congress set up two new committees to deal with the cyber issue and give them jurisdiction. And that means some other committees may have to lose some jurisdiction. That's very hard. Most people that have looked at this say that may be the hardest thing we've proposed. But we just felt like we weren't going to make halfway recommendations. We wanted to recommend, take a blank sheet of paper and say, what will work? What do we need? And lay that before Congress and the administration, and hopefully we will be able to move forward. I'm optimistic. I think the report is very solid. There's no hint of partisanship in this issue. I mean, it just isn't. A cyber attack that steals our intellectual property, you know, that hits Republicans and Democrats and independents and everybody else. So I'm very hopeful, but realistic. This is a tall order. But we just felt like we had to try to meet a very serious threat with a very serious response.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. I want to say thank you to Representative Mike Gallagher for joining us. I know you have to head off, but thanks for taking time out to talk with us today.
Thank you. It was an honor.
And we'll take your calls on the other side of the break. The number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. Woodford's Family Services, reminding you that you can make a difference in the life of a Maine child today by becoming a foster parent. Woodfords.org. And Black Cow Burgers and Fries, a cocktail bar and soda fountain on Exchange Street in Portland, with dine-in or takeout service. BlackCowBurgers.com.
Census workers are preparing to count the homeless population, but the growing coronavirus outbreak could complicate their efforts.
One, workers could be reluctant to go to a place where the homeless receive services. Two, the places could be reluctant to let people in.
How the coronavirus could affect the census, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Today is Rescan Day. If you watch Maine Public Television Channel 26 from Biddeford in southern Maine, and if you watch it over the air, not on cable or satellite, WMEA Television along with WSCH and WPXT in southern Maine have all adjusted their channel designations, so this means you must rescan your television to be able to receive the signal over the air. A positive result of this change, for those of you not able to receive Maine Public Television from Biddeford, is that you may now be able to, as the new signal is stronger and reaches further, including into the greater Portland area. Rescan your television to find out. For more information, please visit mainepublic.org and click on the television drop-down for Television Rescan Day.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, our nation's cybersecurity. Can it be safeguarded, and how? My guests are Senator Angus King. He's co-chair of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, which has just issued a report today on preventing cyber attacks, and Peter Singer, author, strategist, and senior fellow at New America. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to bring in Peter Warren Singer, who's been standing by patiently. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to get your take. I guess initially you've heard the two co-chairs of the commission. This is a report that I guess we've heard bits and pieces from previews of in the recent weeks. But how closely has it been watched? What do you think its impact will be, I guess, on the overall effort of the United States to defend itself from these aggressors?
Well, I'm going to echo what was said by the members of Congress there. This is it's a landmark report, and there's a lot of parallels in history. The positive parallel that I think they hope for is that one with the original Solarium, where it was a moment that essentially set U.S. strategy throughout the Cold War. And this has the potential of doing that, arguably maybe resetting U.S. cybersecurity strategy for not just the next several years, but next several decades. But you also have the worrisome one that the senator made to those moments that we had warning, whether it's the parallel of Pearl Harbor or more recently the parallel of 9/11, where you had warning of what might happen beforehand. And action wasn't taken, and then it was lamented. And so that's why I think this commission is so important. And it's definitely being watched. Like you know, my concern is it kind of relates to so much else, is that, you know, they went about it in the exact right way, bipartisan, brought in experts. The challenge is that's a real rarity right now. So, you know, hopefully it can work because of that.
What in there, you know, there are 75, more than 75, I guess, proposals. Are there any that stand out, do you think, that are sort of, I guess, the most critical or that would have the most impact on changing the status quo of where we are on cyber self-defense?
It's almost like you're asking me to say in front of Senator King, you know, which of his kids do I like the best, right? you know, it's got 75 different recommendations. I think, you know, to look, there's not going to be any one thing that solves this, because we're talking about a problem set that involves threat actors that range from governments like a China that are seeking to steal intellectual property and make copies of it, to governments that have been proven to try and sabotage our democracy. But you also have problems of criminal groups that are engaged in everything from their own theft of, you know, our personal information, company information, but also starting to try and hold things hostage via ransomware. So, you know, I'm a little bit, you know, leery of seeing kind of one thing. I think what I like about it is that it went after that in a very systematic way and said, okay, what do we need to change, for example, in the Congress? What do we need to change, for example, in our approach at the State Department? What do we need to change, for example, in the relationship between business and the government on cybersecurity? My guess is that it'd be great if we could get all 75. We're in a much better place if we get, you know, whatever percentage of that.
Senator King, you mentioned earlier the creation of House and Senate cybersecurity committees. Also in here, the creation of a Senate-confirmed national cyber director. Is that a cabinet position or where?
It would not be a cabinet position, but it would be a high-ranking position in the executive office of the president, similar to the U.S. Trade Representative. That's the model, which is someone who's in the executive office of the president but is Senate-confirmed and therefore has a special stature. And I think that's an important point. Part of the problem, one of my principles of life is that structure is policy. And if you have a messy, incoherent structure, you're probably going to have messy, incoherent policy. And part of the problem right now in the federal government is that we've got cyber scattered all over the place and nobody's really in charge. There used to be a cyber director at the National Security Council. That position was abolished 3 or 4 years ago. And hasn't been replaced, and it was a very strong consensus of the commission that this is that there had to be somebody at the top, that somebody with the stature of the White House that could do coordination, knock heads, communicate directly with the Congress. So that's one of the reorganizations. I also mentioned the reorganization within the Congress. There's also part of this is allies. We're always stronger with allies, and I think America forgets sometimes that China and Russia have clients, but they don't really have allies. And we have people that we're tied to by mutual interest, by friendship, by tradition. And one of the things we're recommending is an undersecretary of state who will be in charge of working with the international community to develop cyber rules of the road. What's the international understanding? So if, for example, a nation state violates those international standards, then they're facing not only the United States, but they're facing a worldwide response. If sanctions apply, for example, everywhere in the world, not just here, that can be much more effective. So those are some examples of how changing the structure we believe will actually lead to a more consistent and effective policy.
The number is 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Let's go to the phones now. We'll bring in Constantino, who's calling from Westbrook. Hi, Constantino. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good, thanks. You're on the air.
A couple of comments. Seems to me that Mr. King has a pretty lucid, cogent plan, but he is facing two big obstacles, namely Trump and McConnell. Basically, Mr. Trump will not even admit the Russians hacked the 2016 elections because he fears it delegitimizes his presidency. And Mr. McConnell, I believe, is sitting on a bill, even as we speak, spending more money to shore up cybersecurity for the elections.
All right. Yeah, thank you, Constantino. Yeah, go ahead.
Senator. Well, Constantino, he's looking at the reality, and that's the reality that we're looking at. And I've already started talking to leadership here. I haven't talked to Senator McConnell yet, but one of our members of our commission was Ben Sasse, who's a Republican senator from Nebraska, and we're going to just try to make the case. And I don't think there are obstacles for sure, but this isn't really a partisan issue. The election of 16 clearly has partisan overtones, but that's not the focus of the report. The report is really forward-looking. And as one of my Republican friends here says, Vladimir Putin is not a Republican. He's an opportunist, and he may help somebody one time and somebody else the other time. The point is, we don't want foreigners messing around in our election. The president clearly is sensitive about 2016. We all know that. On the other hand, he's taken a pretty strong and forward-looking and, I think, correct position with regard to the danger of the Chinese Huawei system for 5G. So at least on that issue, I think he's been good, and he's worked with his advisors. So we're hoping that we can make some inroads. But, there's no – I'm not – yeah, go ahead.
Okay. How do you feel about his naming of Ratcliffe for the DNI?
Well, that hasn't. We're going to have a hearing at the Intelligence Committee, and I've made a policy of, since I'm on the committee and will be at the hearing, have a chance to question him, to not take a firm position. I can tell you, though, that as a general principle, I'm very concerned and have been back in the Obama administration about any effort to politicize intelligence. I think intelligence has to come straight. It has to be the truth. And it worries me that if we're talking about having a director that has a political bent, that could be a danger. Dan Coats, the former director, who, by the way, was a Republican senator and turned out to be a terrific director, he summed it up. He said, our job is to seek the truth and tell the truth. And that's what I'm hoping for. So I'm going to reserve judgment. But the issue of politicization of intelligence is one I'm absolutely very concerned about.
Constantino, thank you. I'm going to try to go to, Fletcher in Biddeford. Fletcher, are you there?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I've been looking forward with great anticipation to this report, and if anything exceeded my expectations, I think it's really, really great. Two-thirds of the way through, but so far it's really an impressive piece of work. My concern, Angus, you know my role.
Yep.
My concern is...
I'm not sure we know your role.
Okay, I am CEO of GWI, which is a network provider in Maine. A focus on the security of the network itself. Is there any recognition of that? It doesn't seem to have made it into the report in an explicit form.
I can't give you a page number, Fletcher, but as I recall, there is a provision that talks about the importance of network security and ISPs, because clearly that's one of the basic building blocks of the whole deal. You can be assured that that's part of what we're focusing on, because it insofar as there's a federal role in ensuring that level of security, that's part of our job.
Okay. One follow-up comment is being from industry, I think it's really great that they're carrots, and would like the more carrots, the better. But ultimately, you know, I think there's no around the fact that they're going to need to be some sticks too. The network has become life critical, and we generally don't let people create products that risk lives. You have to have a safe car, and there are penalties for producing a car that isn't safe. So, the lightest regulation possible is the best regulation. But to achieve the goal, I think there needs to be a recognition that there's going to have to be some ramp up.
Well, I think one of our most interesting recommendations is that there be created an agency like UL, Underwriters Laboratories. You see the little UL label on light fixtures, and it's a testing, basically a testing agency. It's not a federal agency, and when you buy something, you can have a pretty good reliance that it's not going to burn up. We're suggesting exactly the same thing for cyber, for products. That they have to be, and for cloud services, that they have to be certified. They don't have to be, but they should. The consumers will decide, but we're offering that. We want to create that option and have the market drive people toward heightened cybersecurity in their products in the private sector. We really tried hard to tread a line between not too heavy regulation, but also not ignoring the risk in the private sector.
Yeah, I want to bring in Peter Singer on this. Is this the tricky part from where you sit, which is the getting the private sector aid to cooperate with the government, to want to work with the government on something so complicated, and where further restrictions may not work? But I'm just curious: is that the game? Is that the trick here? Is getting these two entities to work together?
It's part of the challenge. And really, when we say private sector, we have to break it down. So there's some parts of the private sector that are, frankly, a little bit ahead of where not just their peers, but where the government is even in its own cybersecurity. They get the risk. They understand it. They don't need the incentives. These are examples like banks or defense contractors, among the ones that were sort of targeted first and get it most clearly. And then we've got other parts of the private sector that, you know, frankly, have been lagging behind. You heard from the senator about certain parts of critical infrastructure. And it's here, you know, again, the story is not just of the power grid going down. In the opening of the report, we talk about some of the other threats that are out there, for example, water treatment or air travel, et cetera. But you also have big vectors through like retail and public health. And so you are seeing first, there's sort of a mismatch. Second, I think one of the issues is that as the internet is changing and our use of it is changing, the company's own views of these threats are going to change. So right now, most people think about cyber threats as some kind of loss of information, my email being stolen, my credit card information being stolen. But more and more, we're going to see cyber threats that cause physical change. Ransomware, where the systems don't run, a fire caused by a deliberate overload of an Internet of Things device. So again, what you asked is part of the challenge. I think what the report is about is trying to say, hey, we can visualize this is coming. Let's try and get ahead of it rather than like 9/11, waiting for the bad thing to happen and then putting the legislation in effect.
Well, one of the examples, Keith, is we recommend in the for public companies that are on the stock exchange, they now have to certify every year to the Securities and Exchange Commission their financial viability. They have to give an annual report with all the data, all the numbers. We're proposing that they also, as part of that process, would have to certify their cybersecurity, their cyber solvency, if you will, because we think that's relevant information for their stockholders, for people that are interested in the company. Now, that's one where we may get some resistance. We've talked to private companies and say, yeah, we're already doing it, and we ought to do it, and everybody ought to do it. But that's an example where that's going to be probably there will be some resistance to that, as I say. But I just think it's common sense at this point. And in fact, the SEC has already made a kind of suggestion, if you will, that they do this. And we're taking the suggestion and saying, no, that should be required.
All right. We're going to take another quick break to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566, 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Finance Authority of Maine, providing financial solutions that help Maine people achieve their business and higher educational goals. FameMaine.com. And Breakwater in Portland, offering April vacation camp and summer day camp programs. Register at enrichment.breakwaterlearning.org. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The Bath Iron Works built USS Nevada is commissioned by the U.S. Navy on March 11, 1916. The Nevada served in both World Wars. In World War II, it was one of the battleships trapped when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. The Nevada was hit by one torpedo and at least six bombs while steaming away from Battleship Row, forcing the crew to beach the stricken ship on a coral ledge. The ship continued to flood and eventually slid off the ledge and sank to the harbor floor.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Scher and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine!
Hello, I'm Philip Yun, host of World Affairs. El Salvador has one of the highest homicide rates in the world. With gangs controlling entire neighborhoods, it's a country where most citizens live in fear. But how did El Salvador descend into violence, and what role did the U.S. play? Next on World Affairs, William Wheeler draws on interviews with gang members, reformers, crime investigators, and government officials to understand El Salvador's violence.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how the nation can prepare for the possibility of a catastrophic cyber attack and what that means for individuals as well. Joining me, Peter Singer, a strategist and senior fellow at New America, and Senator Angus King, co-chair of the Cyberspace Solarium Commission. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. A lot of what we're talking about today in this report released is obviously very high tech, but one of the recommendations actually goes back in time a little bit, Senator, and that is the proposal to return to paper ballots.
Yeah, we're not unaware of the irony of a high tech Solarium Cyber Commission talking about paper ballots, but that's the surest way to protect our election integrity. And there are, I can't remember, I think there are 8 or 9 states that still have essentially internet or electronic-based voting systems that really are very vulnerable. And if you have a paper trail that you can audit afterwards and determine, you know, exactly where it goes, that's critically important. Because remember, an adversary doesn't necessarily have to change the results. They don't necessarily have to blow the whole thing up. All they need to do is cast doubt. Our electoral system is based upon trust that people cast their votes. They think it's going to, they believe and should understand that it's going to count and that the results they get that night or the next morning are the accurate count. And what we're worried about is an attack that doesn't necessarily fully disable the system, but raises doubt and distrust of the results. And that would really, that would be just, you know, awful for our democracy.
I'm curious, do you propose at all in any other way kind of getting off the grid, if you will, but that is either isolating or localizing these systems that have become so connected to the internet and so, you know, automated?
Well, we're not technicians. We don't propose particular technological solutions. There are such things. One measure is called air gapping, which is basically keeping a computer system within your company or that's not on the internet that you can operate internally. There are all kinds of technical solutions. We're not in the business of recommending solutions, but we are in the business of recommending that this be taken seriously and that whatever the solution is coming from the private consultants or experts in the field will be effective in protecting your company. And I should say, you asked Mike Gallagher, and by the way, he had to go and vote on the House floor. He wasn't just mad at us. That's why he had to leave, you know, doing his job here. But we've got recommendations throughout talking about how the private sector can protect itself. And part of this, Keith, is what I call digital literacy. A big part of what the Russians did to us in 2016, and they're already doing it again this year, is disinformation, trying to sow discord and confusion and divisiveness in our society. And one of the things that has to happen is we have to be more discerning consumers of information. We have to get a better idea of when we're being conned, when we're being lied to, and how to sort out the truth from something that isn't the truth. I mean, I've on the Intelligence Committee, I've seen amazing examples of things you just wouldn't believe. Well, unfortunately, a lot of people did believe them. But disinformation. We're a free country. We have a First Amendment. We can limit that kind of thing from foreign countries, but we can't really limit it from other fellow citizens. But we all have to be better at figuring out what's the truth and what isn't. Otherwise, again, we're into confusion and chaos, and that only plays into the hands of our adversaries.
Let's go to Amy in Thomaston. Let's see. Amy, are you there?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. And thank you, Senator King, for taking on this very important issue. I really appreciate it. I work in cybersecurity. I live and work in Maine, but I'm a director of proactive services for a New York company called Blue Buoyant. And I can say that a lot of people who are interested in cyber get confused by the finer nuances of it. sometimes because cybersecurity is really tricky. And so even companies with good intentions tend to struggle with it. And I agree with what you were saying earlier about the testing of products for their security, and that's in the report. But a bigger part of the problem is how products are implemented. And if a surveillance camera or a doorbell is implemented the wrong way, it can lead to a breach of systems. So I really like the DoD's move towards the CMC program and away from the self-assessment of the NIST 800-171. And I was wondering.
Wow, you are into this.
Yeah, I was going to say. You lost me there.
Go ahead.
Basically, let me just, I don't want to take up too much time. I just want to say they're moving away from self-assessment to third-party assessment. And the reason why is because only 45% of the companies that are self-assessing are getting it right. And part of that's just because they don't have the technical expertise. And part of it is that it costs a lot of money. But the move to CMMC and providing a little financial incentive seems to make a lot of sense to me.
Well, and one of the things you'll be interested that we're recommending is mandatory pen testing of public companies, that they're going to have to be subjected to somebody, a friendly, trying to hack them and see how good their systems are. You've probably had the experience. You go to the CEO of the company, how are you doing on cybersecurity? Oh, we're great. And then it turns out they aren't so great. So I agree with you. And the private sector is particularly in the critical infrastructure, in financial, transportation, telecommunications, and the grid. That's where we really have to focus our attention.
All right, Amy, thank you. Senator, there's only a few minutes left, and I promised at the top of the show I did want to run a few questions by you about this other major national story that we're dealing with, and that is the arrival of coronavirus. I guess I would lead with, there are questions being asked of Congress and whether the White House are doing enough, all that they can to curb the spread, but also help hospitals and healthcare providers treat those who become ill. Are they, and what should be done?
Well, the first thing, very first thing, and I think most important thing I can say is, if people are wondering and thinking and don't know what to do and have questions, there's a very good website called coronavirus.gov. Put together by the Center for Disease Control, and it's very good. I was just on it this morning. It has a lot of information, what to do, what not to do. So I think that's a place to start. It's a good place to get straight information. In terms of, are we doing enough? Probably not. I think the administration was slow off the ball here. But last week, in a matter of 48 hours, the Congress passed a very comprehensive and well-funded initiative to deal with this in terms of the health aspects, testing, working on a vaccine, assistance to medical facilities across the country. So I think that's starting to get out. I think part of it is also leading by example. Frankly, somebody told me this morning the vice president has announced he's going to keep shaking hands with people. Well, that's not right. This is a serious matter. And it can go – I think last Saturday there was one person in New Rochelle, New York, one guy, and now there are 46 people. I think that's the number in that town. This thing can explode, and it explodes through human contact. And for a politician to say no handshaking is that's hard. But that's the kind of thing that we have to do. And this is a very serious matter. As you know, the World Health Organization about an hour ago pronounced this a worldwide pandemic. So, what do we do? Personal hygiene, washing your hands, keeping your hands away from your face, don't shake hands. And I think, we're going to see more and more large sort of collections of people not happening. There was a big dinner here in Washington on Saturday that's been canceled. And, the two Democratic candidates canceled their rallies last night in Cleveland. We're just going to have to try to mitigate this and also try to contain it at the same time.
So within the general public, there seems to be a spectrum of personal opinions or philosophies toward this, ranging from, on the one end, gee, this is a serious public health emergency, to, on the other end, wash your hands, live your life, this too shall pass. Is that spectrum reflected among members of Congress as well, or are you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, last week we had a member of Congress, a member of the House, go to the floor with a gas mask on. He was being cute, and unfortunately, one of his constituents died of the disease the next day. But let me just put this into perspective: the garden variety flu that we all know about and we have our shots in the fall kills between 35,000 and 45,000 people a year. It's the death rate is about 0.1%. In other words, 0.1% of the people that have that flu die. This coronavirus, the estimates range from 2% to 3.5% death rate. And, you know, 2% is 20 times the death rate for the regular flu. So this is not something that's made up. It's not something that, you know, we can sort of laugh off. It isn't the regular flu. So we really have to take it seriously. I've made some decisions. I decided not to go to a major dinner here in Washington, and I'm going to try to, I'm washing my hands and doing all those kinds of things. We're all elbow bumping down here, yeah. The danger is that it grows geometrically. It goes from one person to two to four to six, and or two to four to eight to 16, and that's the danger. And so we just have to try to isolate ourselves and not let it spread.
I mean, you've seen that Bowdoin has announced it will not let students return to campus after spring break.
I just saw that. Yeah.
So you view that as the kind of appropriate response that private institutions can take to protect?
Well, it seems a little extreme, but I think here's an anecdote. The Spanish flu in 1918, which, by the way, killed 50 million people across the world and 600,000 in America. In Philadelphia, the health commissioner refused to stop a big parade that was happening in the town and didn't take any real proactive steps. 12,000 people died. In St. Louis, the health commissioner said, you know, we're going to shut down major events. We're not going to have baseball, ball games, whatever. And 1,700 people died. So there are two sort of stories. And I guess the answer is, it's a cliche, better be safe than sorry. I'd rather be preventive and maybe go overboard a little bit on the prevention than have to suffer what our country suffered 100 years ago.
All right. And with that, we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Keith. Thanks for taking the time with us this morning or this afternoon.
Senator Angus King, U.S. Senator from Maine, who co-chairs the Cyberspace Solarium Commission, and Peter Warren Singer, strategist and senior fellow at New America and author of many books, including on the topic of cybersecurity. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.